Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various events and issues that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. The death of a parent, sibling, or other important person in a child's life is one of the most frequently reported disruptive childhood experiences, and without support can lead to adverse health and welfare outcomes. When Natasha Daniels' healthy 42-year-old husband suddenly died of a blood clot, she and her three children were thrown into the darkness of grief. Her children experienced difficulty eating, sleeping, and focusing. People treated them differently, and they lost some friends. They had to learn how to navigate in a world that felt upside down. Natasha Daniels, mother, therapist, and author of The Grief Book, a book to understand grief and love. Welcome to 411 Teen, Natasha. I'm very glad to have you. She joins us on the Zoom platform from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the information you have to share is invaluable. It's something just about, in this day and age, more and more kids are experiencing. Would you share your inspiration or impetus in writing your recent book, The Grief Book?
Yeah, actually, it wasn't about writing a book. It was just being desperate and trying to help, particularly my youngest, who was really having a hard time with grief and not having the tools or the language, and just getting her a ton of books. And it just wasn't hitting the spot. And so I started to just talk about this boulder that just crashed into our house, and this rock that now we have to hold and manage and carry with us. And it became this just really good analogy for us to check in. You know, how big is your rock today? Mm-hmm. Or for her to communicate and say, you know, Mom, my rock is too big. I can't talk about this right now. And so it became kind of a way for us to talk about grief. And about a year later, I decided I was going to write these words down and maybe pay it forward and see if I can get that out into the world as well.
Well, there are a lot of books out there on children and dealing with death and grief. What would you identify as the distinguishing feature of your book?
The thing that was the hardest for grief, even for me as a child therapist, but not a grief therapist, was the physiological aspect. So the impact it had on my body and my kid's body, you know, the inability to sleep, the hard process of eating, and then separate from that, how other people interacted with you. And these are things that I feel like aren't discussed as much when we're talking about grief and how to navigate it, is these concrete things that can make you feel overwhelmed because your world is already kind of upside down, but then you can't do the things that normally help you function, and you can't be around the people that normally support you.
Western culture differs significantly from other cultures in ways of looking at death and dying and bereavement. I find in most Western cultures, children grow up protected from death. I mean, in other parts of the world, the young folks seem to be exposed to death quite early through whatever it may be, war, natural disaster, famine. What are your thoughts about that? Would you agree with that? Or is that, you know, am I just twisted in looking at it that way?
No, I agree with you. I think it's sanitized in Western cultures. And it wasn't until really we started to travel the world after my husband died, because we realized, you know, life is short. You just want to soak it up, that I saw the different ways that grief was handled in other cultures. And there was just such a welcoming normalization of grief and communities supporting each other and having the bodies be around and going through traditions and rituals around the grieving process and the body. And I feel like here it's often sanitized. And so people who are experiencing it become an other that you don't you may not know how to interact with because you don't know what to say or do because it's it seems like something that's scary and something that doesn't happen to the rest of us.
You have any insights as to why we have that take on it? Why in the Western culture it's addressed in that manner? Because our culture is a combination of a lot of other cultures, and those specific cultures don't deal with it in that way. Do I make sense?
Yeah, I don't know why that is. It would be a really good research study because I don't know why that happens, that it's so separate. You know, we go to the hospital, they remove the body. We don't deal with that. We don't talk about it. Get back to work, you know, chop, chop. You know, so it's this mentality of, okay, I'm sorry that happened to you. We'll give you a few weeks and then let's get back to it. And that just seems like it's a cultural norm, which is unfortunate.
For example, a dominant attitude in the Western culture is that nature exists to be used and controlled. We control nature. Although we don't, but that's our idea. Other cultures don't seem to share that same view. Do you think that folks who believe they can be protected from nature have less respect for the power of nature over life? Because, you know, we do think we can control nature. Or at least that is our attitude. Climate change doesn't exist. You know, it only exists if we allow it to. That's sort of the attitude here.
It is. It's the attitude of control, right? Mm-hmm. Like I can control this. And how can I prevent that from happening to us? And I think that we do this almost subconsciously is let me separate out her story from my story so I know that can't happen to me.
Exactly.
Instead of realizing that grief will impact all of us and you don't have control. And kids who are going through grief have that epiphany that we actually, my mom and dad or whoever is my caregiver, can't prevent me from experiencing grief or can't prevent bad things from happening at times because we don't get to control everything.
But you know, our attitude here is that we do. And so that just spills over into every aspect of life. Yeah. What about religion? What influence does religion have on how we cope with death? Or what have you experienced? What have you seen?
You know, I think it depends on the belief system because I've seen very religious, quote unquote, religious people struggle greatly in their grief because their belief is maybe surface. And so I almost feel like it's more of your belief system and like what you truly, truly resonates with you, you know, not that you go to, you know, a place to worship, but that you have a belief in why this chaos of life makes sense to you. And that's an individual thing. Mm-hmm. And with kids, it's even more complicated because sometimes they just adopt their family's belief system, but grief puts it to a test because those platitudes aren't really resonating if a child doesn't really have that belief system. Right. And so it can be very helpful as far as putting structure to the chaos. You know, any kind of spiritual belief can help with that. And so it just depends on the family.
Do you find in therapy that you attempt to incorporate the religious component of grief or how their particular religion impacts in it? Or are you more just dealing with, okay, this is where it's at, you know, how do you handle that in therapy?
Well, luckily I don't do therapy with grieving kids.
Okay.
Which I know sounds weird.
No.
Part of the struggle for me is that I'm an anxiety and OCD child therapist and really am like skill building and solution focused and neuroplasticity and let's change your brain and a lot more of that control, right? That component of control.
Mm-hmm.
So even with my own kids, when grief popped up, I'm like, where can I control this? This is a mess.
Yeah.
And I do believe belief can come into that. And you have to respect that as far as when you're talking about grief, what is the family culture around belief and how is that part of it or not part of it and being respectful either way.
Well, I know in looking at working with children that grief can look different in a child, because children grieve. There's so many components or variables that influence how the child is affected. I mean, their age, their development, their relationship to the person who died, how the child is cared for during and following the death, how family communicates with the child about death. Would you talk about how children grieve differently than adults? And I know that, you know, with children, it depends on their age, because children aren't as sophisticated as teens, so we'll get to teens, but let's look at how children grieve.
I think every human being deals with grief differently, mm-hmm. and kids included. And they might have irritability. They might be more aggressive. They might be more hyperactive. You know, I think sometimes we're looking for just sadness and we're missing mm-hmm. the nuances, mm-hmm. you know, just some dysregulation, or even on the opposite end of that, you know, seem happy-go-lucky, like, shouldn't they be upset? Which actually right. can be very triggering for a widow to be like, why are you, you know, you want to go to your friend's house? You know, your parent just died. And understanding that kids will try to adapt in whatever way they possibly can. And, you know, looking at that behavior and then understanding what's going on underneath that behavior is so important.
That's true. And also, as you mentioned, and I mentioned that the age is so very influential as to how they deal with it. First of all, they don't have the skills, the communication skills, to maybe even pull together how they are really feeling and what is going on. They may not even know how they're feeling.
Right. Yeah. And we might speak in abstract terms, like, mm-hmm. you know, he went to heaven and he's up in the sky, and that kids are very literal when they're little to sleep, you know? And so I've worked with kids, you know, in the past who are afraid to sleep or are looking up into the sky because they're so literal and concrete when they're really young that these euphemisms and these expressions mm-hmm. are completely confusing to little kids.
Yeah. And it's difficult. It's difficult for parents too, because they don't know what to say and they don't know how to interpret. And I think you mentioned that earlier, what they're seeing, how it presents to them. I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I am talking with Natasha Daniels. She is the author of a new book, The Grief Rock. We're going to take a quick break. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Natasha Daniels. She is the author of the new book, The Grief Rock. Natasha, teens may express their grief in different ways. We just briefly talked about what you may see in younger children. What types of behaviors should we be looking for? And teens. And yes, recognizing that each one of them may deal with them differently, but there are some commonalities.
Yeah. It depends on the teen, mm-hmm. because sometimes you might see that they're trying to escape home. More often they have the capability of leaving. And so they might want to be with their friends more, or they want to be away from the house, which is kind of the epicenter of all the struggles if it's a parent or a sibling who passed away. Conversely, you might see a teen who's like not functioning, and they don't want to hang out with their friends, and they're, you know, not eating or sleeping, not able to focus and do, you know, their schoolwork, withdrawing from things that they normally find engaging. And so it really can be across the board. You might even have a teen who feels like now it's their time to take care of you. I feel like that happened with my daughter, who was 18 at the time. Mm-hmm. There was more of like an almost maternal shift in our relationship, where I had to frequently verbalize to her that you are not my co-parent. I don't want you to have that burden. You're not here to support me or to take care of your other two siblings, that you get to still be a kid. You know, she was about to go off to college, and she was in the middle of her senior year, and I really didn't want her to have that extra pressure. And so I think as parents, we also need to say, are they taking on a new role or a burden that I should be aware of and that I need to kind of catch, you know, in midstream so I can make sure that I can correct that?
Well, I think you touched on it. We often say if you see any type of extremes or changes in behavior, those vegetative signs, if it's eating, if it's sleeping, if it's attitude, if it's irritability, anything that is really deviates from their norm, that might be an indicator that something is going on. How important is it to keep the lines of communication open?
It's so crucial because a lot of times what you see is not what you're actually getting. Mm-hmm. And being able to check in, sometimes just want like a little comment or a little question is an invitation to allow them to disclose to you their struggles. And so checking in with them periodically and finding different ways to say, are you okay? Not just, how are you doing? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. Finding creative ways to tap into that periodically is really important because a lot of times it will look like they're doing okay and they're just waiting for that invitation to be able to to tell you they're not.
Yes. Well, I commend you on your book. I love the illustrations in it, okay? I thought they were just really very, very apropos. Thanks to your illustrator, Lily Fawcett.
Lily Fawcett.
Yeah, the illustrations were good. As we talk about the book, The Grief Rock by Natasha Daniels, share with the listening audience where they can get this book.
The Grief Rock is anywhere you get your books, so hopefully. Okay. Definitely Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get books. You can always go to natashadaniels.com/grief, which will take you to Amazon to be able to see it there.
Okay. For parents, what are some of the signs that their younger children, their kids, may need professional help in coping with the loss of a loved one?
I think in general, it's just good for us to connect our kids to a grief support group if there's one in your area. Mm-hmm. Most of the time there's not gonna be, but if there is one, it's something to tap into. Even if they just go once or twice, just to normalize grief. We were really lucky to have one in our area. And my son and my oldest daughter chose not to go. They went to like one or two, saw they weren't alone. They were done with it. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. And my youngest, she wanted to stay there forever. You know, so eventually I had to be like, we're not going to go anymore. You know? But if your child is just like any issue, if they are showing a change in their behavior, if they are withdrawing, not able to function, you know, academically, they are doing worse. Conversations about blame. I think a lot of kids and adults do this too. Own the death. Mm-hmm. It's their fault somehow. And I mean, it's amazing how creative our brain can get on right. 6 degrees to why it's my fault, you know? And so is your child saying things like that? I had to really listen in to my kids and see what they were saying. And eventually I saw my youngest daughter, she was saying, she wasn't saying it's my fault, but she's saying, I'm sorry he didn't love me enough. And I was like, what, tell me more about that. Like, what part of him not loving you, where are you getting that? And eventually I realized that she felt like if her dad loved her, his soul would not have chosen to leave, which I got because I felt that way too, kind of on a spiritual level. And so tapping into...
Well, his soul may not have chosen to leave, you know, to be honest about
right.
it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't want to carry that weight or that own that death. And I find that kids do this more so. I mean, adults do this too, where we'll find, and teens for sure, what we did in that moment that was bad. So we can feel like shame and guilt. But I think if your kids are doing that and you can't really process that with them, or they need a neutral place to process it because we're a component of this. A lot of kids are protective. I know my kids were protective, even though I articulated over and over, you guys are kids. I've got you. We're going to get through this. I'm still your parent. I'm still going to provide for you. They didn't want to burden with me. They didn't want to burden me. And so if you're sensing that for your child, it might be time to get them their own space to have someone to talk to.
Okay. And talk about how they may experience it. Problems with sleeping. I think a lot about the nightmares and kids particularly not wanting to go to sleep, where with teens you might see them sleeping all the time. Can you elaborate on that? And I know, again, everything we're saying is really, it depends on the child, on the individual. But there are some homogeneity that we see there as far as behaviors.
Yeah, sleep is a huge disruption for so many reasons. First, I think physiologically, there's trauma to the brain. And so the brain is really, the circadian rhythms are off whack. Exactly. And I mean, I was like, what is going on here? And so just on a physiological level, your brain's not okay. Your child's or your teen's brain's not okay. And so all rhythms are off. But then we get into the weeds a bit. And sleep is actually kind of like a mini death, if you really think about it. I'm going to shut my eyes and I'm going to disappear for 8 hours and hopefully come back on the other side. And that's scary when death is really close. And then if you add another layer that, you know, you're using language like he went to sleep, or he actually, like in our case, literally did go to sleep and never woke up. The fear is is much more intense. I mean, my youngest had so much anxiety at night because she wasn't sure if I would be there in the morning.
Yeah, that does tend to carry over. Well, if it happened to Daddy, I mean, is Mommy next?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's natural. You recommended groups, but sometimes individual therapy is really what is indicated. And I guess you might say it's just the degree, the level of severity, the impact, that will determine whether they want to go to a group or whether you see an individual therapist. How would you address that?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is what does your child or teen want? Unless it's, you know, a concern, a danger to themselves or other people, you know, where you're like, really, their safety is at stake and really need to get them some clinical help. For every child, it's different. And so I wanted to expose my kids to all of those things and then say, what do you think you need? And give them some autonomy to say, I respect your journey. And I want to provide those tools, but I'm not going to force them, because then it actually becomes kind of this negative thing that can happen where they're like resentful that they have to go to therapy and they're angry that they have to talk, you know, and then it kind of ruins therapy for them moving forward because they've been forced to do it. So I'm not really a big proponent of forcing therapy, but I think giving them an introduction to it is really helpful.
And then with the very young, I mean, and I'm talking about preschoolers, they see death as being temporary, you know, because that road runner or whatever cartoon character that they saw that got smashed by the car, in the next episode is up and running around. So, and I mean, and that gives them, you know, somewhat, they're confused about the whole concept of death. So how does one... How do you know, okay, when they have a real ability, a cognitive ability, to comprehend the concept of death? That death, well, I guess some religious folks would differ with me, but death, as we know it, is permanent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, and even when they have a pet, you know, the pet may die, the dog may get hit by a car, but a lot of parents run out and get another dog.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And I mean, it is in our culture where, you know, we have nine lives on their video games and it's in our cartoons and in our movies. And that idea of permanency developmentally, you know, it's not even hardwired until they're, you know, between 8 months and 2 years. And so just object permanency in general is not a skill they're getting. You drop them off at preschool and they're not sure you're going to come back. And so that is just developmentally a struggle.
Yeah.
And we don't help with our softened words. you know, daddy's in heaven or daddy's in the sky, you know, or daddy's watching you. That could be a little creepy and concerning.
Yes.
And,
you know, it certainly
because they're
could.
Very literal. They're literal. So you kind of have to, you know, and even my kids who were like, my youngest was 9, mm-hmm. Like a month or two into grieving, she would be like, when's he coming back?
Uh-huh.
And I was, you know, like, what, you know, why are you not getting this? But it's just, the brain is just in denial. And that's a child who developmentally is far beyond a toddler preschooler.
Right.
So I think being really concrete with your kids and explaining, and you have to repeat yourself. This is something, I think kids also want you to review it. They'll ask you over and over again the same questions, mm-hmm. which can seem like they're, you know, just, it can seem abnormal, but it actually is very typical during grief that, you know, when's daddy coming home? When will daddy be back? Mm-hmm. And which is very triggering for a widow. I mean, I know that was exhausting mm-hmm. to have to answer the same questions over and over, but they need that concrete answer. You know, he's not coming back. He has died, and it's very sad. And we are all sad that daddy has died, and not sprinkling any kind of abstract to mm-hmm. that to make you feel
indeed.
Better, because it seems like such
indeed.
A sad thing to say.
Yeah,
it helps.
Well, and that same note, and you kind of alluded to it, even though your book is for about kids, what about the parents? Because the parents can only be helpful as they are with themselves. I mean, they have to have some control themselves about what has happened and where to go. I mean, you sounded like you had a good handle on it, but a lot of parents don't.
Yeah, and I really didn't feel like I did. But I mean, I knew enough as a therapist.
Right.
I knew I needed to connect to resources.
Right.
So I knew, you know, the very basics of get them help.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like it is taking care of yourself, a lot of self-compassion, because you're not going to be in the right state of mind to take care of your kids.
Right.
And so there are some really ugly moments, and being able to have compassion for yourself and say, I don't have to, you know, I'm not going to show up 100% all the time. And also getting support. For me, you know, I'm an introvert. My husband was an introvert, and we filled each other's cups, and there was really no extended support system. And all of our family was out of our state. And so it was really an island. And once he left, it was like just me and my 3 kids, and that was it. And not being too afraid to accept help, because strangers will come out of the woodwork. People who barely know you will come out of the woodwork. His coworkers came out of the woodwork, all to help. And I think as those of us that are grieving and needing to be an anchor for our kids, we have to put down that pride and be humble and accept that support.
That was my next question. Did you allow them to help? Because even though folks are there and want to help, sometimes the parents aren't willing to accept that help. And how do you suggest that they move beyond that? Comments, thoughts, because I think the parents, in my opinion, are really very influential about as far as how the child, whether it's a kid or a preteen or the teen, copes with the loss of a loved one.
Yeah, definitely mm-hmm. modeling it, whether mm-hmm. we want to think of that
right.
or not. And for me, I kept reminding myself that if I'm not okay, I can't help my kids. And it really
exactly.
took me really sinking, like completely sinking, to realize I'm going to have to accept some of this help. And when people would say, I'm so sorry for your loss, how can I help you? I would literally think, how can you help me?
Oh, that's good.
Right. Can you pick up my kids, or can you take them
mm-hmm.
out? Or if you offer it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I did find also that people wanted to do something. My husband was a first responder of sorts. And
mm-hmm.
so his coworkers were, they're doers. Mm-hmm. They wanted to help. And I found that, and actually it was, I think, their supervisor who said to me on the phone one day, Natasha, these people want to help. And I don't care if you tell them to bring your trash can in, give them something, because they
mm-hmm.
want to feel like they can help his family. And so I did, to help them.
mm-hmm.
And it actually was, it taught me a life lesson of taking help and support, and that it is okay to get other people to help you and necessary.
And do you have any suggestions as to how parents get to that point? Because I think you've hit it on the head. It's very hard to take that help. It's not that you don't want it. You're just maybe even overwhelmed and don't know where to go. And here's somebody saying, I want to help. And you're thinking, how would you want to help? I mean, you know, this is horrible. You know, all the things that are going through your mind as a parent. Do you have any suggestions that you would offer to parents who may be in that situation?
You know, you want to think about what you need. And you really, your brain is in fight and flight mode. And so you're kind of on survival mode anyway. So you kind of know what you need because you're so overwhelmed. Like your overwhelm will show you what you need. You know, the kids mm-hmm. are overwhelming mm-hmm. or cooking is overwhelming mm-hmm. Or whatever it may be. And some people will offer things that are not helpful. And it can actually wind up being overwhelming because everybody's bringing a dish to you. And you're like, I remember we had this neighbor who we didn't know, they were strangers, and they kept ringing our doorbell every night and bringing us more gifts, which was very thoughtful and kind, but it got overwhelming because they would want their kids to, they'd say, see, they've lost their dad. Why don't you talk to them? What you're, you know, and they were like teaching their kids a life lesson, which I appreciate the effort. But like after the third visit, I was like, just stop, you know, too much. So I think, you know, vocalize your boundaries and, mm-hmm. you know, think about what you need and then offer, you know, please don't bring me any more food. I've got tons. But, you know, if you could actually take my kids, you know, mm-hmm. to the park with your kids, that would be amazing. And mm-hmm. I learned, because I'm a people pleaser by nature. And
hold your thoughts. I'm sorry. This is one of those times when I'm saying, will you please hold your thoughts? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking with Natasha Daniels. She is the author of The Grief Rock. And I had to interrupt you, because I know you were talking, giving some more suggestions right in the middle. So if you want to continue your thoughts, Natasha, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no worries. Okay. Yeah, I do feel like learning how to set boundaries and mm-hmm. and tell people what you need is really helpful. And I was saying I'm a people pleaser. And so by nature, that wasn't my style of communicating. I wanted to make everyone else happy. And so they want to bring me food. And it was like my whole kitchen was full of food. I didn't want to hurt their feelings. It's funny how grief removes that, because I didn't care anymore. It was, you know, I would just my peace because I didn't have time for that. And so that's what I'd recommend for parents is, you know, tell people what you need, tell people what you don't need, and don't be afraid to set a boundary because people don't know what to do.
What other resources can you think, just general community resources that may be available, that they may avail themselves to, they, the parents and the family, and helping to cope with this loss? I mean, I think about even the role of the school. Let's look at the school. What about school and coping and dealing with grief and depression and loss? How do you deal with that?
I feel like grief should be part of the curriculum. I mean, mm-hmm. if one out of 12 kids are going to experience a parental loss or a sibling mm-hmm. loss, that should be part of the conversation in schools because, and that's just, you know, their immediate family. We're mm-hmm. not even talking about grandparents right. or uncles or COVID or all sorts of things that have, you know, increased that. And so just the awareness of grief, what it does physically, how we can support people. So that goes without saying. I don't think there's enough curriculum on grief. But then I also think that schools don't often know what to do with grief. And so they just ignore it. And I was, you know, because I am a therapist, I was able to advocate for my kids and say, they, you know, they need a go-to person at school. They need mm-hmm. someone that they can go to if they're triggered in the middle of, you know, math They don't want to come home and they don't want to cry in front of their peers. Is there a signal they can have with the teacher so that they can go and talk to the counselor for a little while, or just a space where they can have that? So it would be amazing if that was just something that was always considered. You know, it's, we've got lunch, we've got PE, who's going to go and, you know, be that safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that we have some antiquated things happening at schools. I think we're getting better, but I still see it. The daddy and daughter dances, the donuts with dad.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like, can we be so insensitive?
Yes, I know exactly what you're going to say. Go right ahead. I was thinking that you were reading my mind. That's why it just came out like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's not even just about people through grief. I mean, a lot of people have different caregivers, different people in their lives. Yeah. And to highlight what someone may not have, or to put salt in someone's wound by labeling things like that, is it just seems antiquated to me. And so that still happens. Or my kids were in Phoenix, and so there was the Day of the Dead.
Long ago, yeah.
Yeah. And so 2 weeks ago, my daughter, she's now 11, had this assignment, and she said, "Mom, I have to draw a picture of someone who passed away that's close to me, and write something about it." And I thought, what? And it was very triggering for her. And I thought, why would the teacher do that? She goes, "It makes no sense. It's for social studies." Eventually I realized it was Day of the Dead, because I actually was going to write to the school and be like, "Why are you targeting my child?" You know, like, I was getting defensive about it. But that's an assignment. That's an example of a little bit of forethought to parents to say. So they put them all in the hallways, and my daughter was the only one that had like a young person. They were all like, she goes, "Mom," they were all like grandparents and dogs. And there was a picture of me and like a picture of my dad. And so it was insensitive. And I think if schools could just understand grief and how it impacts kids and be a little bit more cognizant of that in their curriculum and their activities, life would be so much better for so many people.
Did you find that your school was receptive to your suggestions and your request?
They were for the time off. My kids actually took a month off, and there was no stress or anything from the school. And they were receptive to the counselor and like having them talk to them. But, you know, not every parent's going to advocate for their kids the way that I did, because I have the clinical skills and the wherewithal to do that. And that's where the concern is.
Mm-hmm. What about, how do you support children when, and this would be very appropriate for you, when they have a sudden loss? And when I say a sudden loss, I'm talking about that loss that occurs when there was no warning, no anticipation, as opposed to that death following a long illness, when they may have begun the grieving process. Do you see that there is any difference in the way that the grief is handled, because they had an opportunity to watch whomever slowly deteriorate, slowly die, as opposed to that one who, you know, was fine and just, like you say, with your husband, didn't wake up?
Yeah, I think grief is hard no matter what, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I know when I was in graduate school and I took a weird class on like how to deliver bad news in the ER. It was a very specific class. Mm-hmm. And I remember the instructor saying, you know, you don't start off with "they have died." You start off with "there was an accident and they hit their head." And you're building it up to protect that brain from overload and shock. You know, you want the brain to process that. And so when families and kids and teens have a little bit of a runway to say, you know, "this person is sick and we're trying to get them better," it's almost preparing the brain. I mean, no one can fully prepare anyone for grief, but when it's sudden, there's a whole bunch of things that happen. I think first, physiologically, the brain is traumatized. Like, I couldn't read. I could barely speak.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were things that were shutting down that were almost as overwhelming as the loss. Like, I didn't have words, and I'm a word person, you know? And I was like, am I ever going to get my brain back? And kids feel that way too. The other thing that's really hard for kids is the impermanence is really highlighted, because it says that this can happen to you. if your dad or your brother or sister can go to bed and then not wake up, or they can get hit by a car, yes, and they were happy this morning and now they're gone.
Right.
What does that mean for me and my mortality? What does it mean for all the people around me? And so that level of rawness of, you know, the facade of permanency, the facade of stability is shaken. And to have that shaken developmentally at a young age or even in teenhood is really overwhelming to the way they view the world. And so that has to be talked about. And mm-hmm. you can't sugarcoat it as a parent, or at least I don't think it's helpful for me mm-hmm. to say to my kids, that won't happen to us, or I will always be here, because I can't guarantee that. So we have to have a different discussion about we live in this moment and we live in this moment and we have these moments, and you'll always be taken care of. I have a will, and your aunt is going to take care of you, and I have a mm-hmm. plan. So you will always be taken care of, but we just have to live in these moments. And that becomes very real to everybody.
At what point would you say, generally, a child, teen, really has the cognitive ability to comprehend the concept of death? And once they have comprehended that concept, does that change or influence really how they cope with it?
It's hard to say when that is, because mm-hmm. I do think that's different for each kid. Certainly when they're really little, there is not a concept of death. But I think most kids are not used to, and teens are not used to young people dying, or people dying out mm-hmm. of order, or a parent who is in the middle of caregiving, you know, during the prime years, it can leave you. And so, I think even if they get the concept of death, they think that it won't touch them and their world, because most kids are dealing with a dog dying or mm-hmm. a grandparent dying. They're not dealing with out of order or caregivers. Obviously 1 in 12 are, but
yeah,
it can be overwhelming. And I think it takes some time to process death, and it does bring a maturity that's unfortunate. I know my kids, I feel like are more mature and sophisticated in a sad sort of way, because I feel like the facade of life has been removed from them, and they see it for what it is, which is we have no control and things can happen.
Yeah. What impact do you think? I got a lot of questions. I'm looking at the clock and we don't have many time, so I'm not thinking. What impact do you think COVID, the pandemic, had on kids and death?
There was so much more death, obviously. Yeah. And so I do feel like that did remove the curtain a little bit on death. And as a society, we couldn't really sanitize it, because so many people were mm-hmm. impacted by a loved one or a friend having COVID and dying. And so the death rates just skyrocketed. Yeah. Mental health issues skyrocketed. And I think the facade of stability, you know, got rocked in the sense that, I mean, besides death, just the grief process of life as we know it, right? So that's, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge loss as well. And so it was kind of like on a societal level, this experience of grief, because our kids, 2 years for our kids is a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And actually my daughter this morning said, do you know it's been almost 4 years since COVID? I don't know if she's actually, I guess she is right about that.
Yeah. She's right.
And I think, and she even said, and then it's been 3 years since dad died. So she's connecting all that loss. Uh-huh. And so I think death and grief came to the forefront for so many of us, and especially for kids and teens who didn't have to deal with that in the past as much as they are even now.
Well, I hate to go to this subject, but what about this whole Israeli-Gaza conflict? No matter what side you're on, folks are dealing with death. I mean, they're living with death. They say the stench of death is all around them. What are your thoughts on that? What are these kids experiencing? And it doesn't matter who they are. I mean, or Israeli, Gaza, doesn't matter, because death is death. And for kids, you know, they are the ones that have to cope with this and deal with this. And since you know, you've written that book about it. What do you think? What do you think?
Yeah, I feel,
how do we address that? Because our kids get it too, okay? Even if they aren't there, it's every place and they can't help but see it. You know, it's mm-hmm. all around them. They can't escape it. You know, whether it's the television or, and they can turn that off and you turn on the internet and you can turn that off and you turn on the radio. I mean, it encompasses us.
Yeah, and it goes back to that
mm-hmm.
reality that that they can't always be, kids can't always be protected.
Right.
And you know, kids unfortunately are really seeing that in a very raw, horrific way in Gaza and Israel. That, I mean, literally their foundation is cracking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, buildings are crumbling and people are dying. And it removes that beautiful innocence that childhood has, that we're all safe and we're all okay and we're always going to be okay. And so, yeah, that reality, and then just even witnessing that and being aware of that is traumatizing, because it sends a message that we don't have control, and that it kind of goes back to that bad things can happen. And that can sound really horrible. Mm-hmm. Like, well, we don't want to tell kids that bad things can happen, but that is the reality.
But it's the reality. Yeah.
And getting them to cope with that bad things can happen. We live in this moment and that moment. I actually have a huge sign that says, you are in this moment. And it was like, I created it on Etsy to just be like, ground me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, that's a tool that we can teach kids, during horrific times, that you have this moment mm-hmm. And not kind of giving them platitudes, because that actually doesn't really help.
No, that doesn't help at all. Well, you said your thing is anxiety. So are we going to see more anxiety amongst this population because of this? Because of all this death and dying and PTSD? What are we seeing? Not to say we haven't even talked about depression, because depression goes hand in hand with it too. There is depression that's going on. Even with the loss and grief, there's depression. It, you know, how we handle that varies according to the individual too. But any thoughts on any of that in the next 2 minutes that we have?
Yeah, I mean, when you feel like you don't have control over everything, that is very anxiety producing. And mm-hmm. when you have global distress, global war, you know, environmental stressors, you know, things happening, earthquakes, volcanoes, you know, mm-hmm. fighting, that the stability that you'd want to foster in childhood is just not there. And so, yeah, I'm seeing that. I mean, I think we are all seeing a spike in anxiety in general and mental health issues overall, because it's the world in and of itself is not a stable place.
And depression, what signs should parents be looking for with depression?
Yeah, depression, if your child is withdrawing or your teen is withdrawing, you know, they're showing like a disinterest in things that they normally found enjoyable, or they're pulling away from their friends, you can't connect with them, or some self-harming behavior. Those are concerns. Or, you know, some reckless behavior over the top, atypical for them, some impulsivity mm-hmm. where they're doing things that are dangerous, or over drinking or using drugs, mm-hmm. you know, things that are obviously red flags. But depression can show up in lots of different ways, and it's not just a curled up kid in their bedroom.
Right.
It can be lots of different ways.
Yeah. I mean, in kids, you may see a lot of acting out, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of defiant behavior, you know, a lot of irritability, a lot of mm-hmm. oppositional. And you think, well, why are you being in that way? Well, what has happened in their world and what is going on? Before we close, share again your book and where we can get it, or where we can connect with you.
And you can find it at any bookstore called The Grief Rock. I do have like an Amazon link. You can go to natashadaniels.com/grief. If you need help with anxiety and OCD, you can find me at atparentingsurvival.com.
Okay. Any last words of wisdom? Any additional resources you may offer to parents or educators that they may take advantage of?
You know, I think just having the dialogue and the discussion in any capacity is something more than nothing. And not just for people who are going through grief and being reactive, you know, something happens in the school and we're going to talk about
mm-hmm.
it, but having that conversation proactively is really helpful.
And I think also just validating how they're feeling. You know, you're it's expected, I mean, wouldn't say that, but that you feel this way. So letting them know, okay, all right, that's what's going on, that's where you're at, and we can, let's talk about it. But it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. I've been talking with Natasha Daniels, author of The Grief Rock. Thank you, Natasha, for sharing all of your expertise. I really appreciate it. And to my listening audience, much appreciation for your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at WFSU.org.